Hello everyone and welcome to another episode of the Squawker Talker podcast. My name is Jake Entwistle and today we're going to be talking all international tournaments as well as a splash of transfer news. And joining me to do just that is regular guest, chief writer at Squawker, Mohammed Butt. How are you?
I'm fantastic. It's been a real weekend of football. You think, oh, football's over now for the season. Nah, mate, there's still plenty to go.
I was going
to
say, if anything, there was more this weekend than in the 3-week abyss before the Champions League final. So
let's never speak of that abyss again.
Yeah, plenty to tuck into. And on my left, as always, cuddling up closely is Mr. Sam Long. Are you all right, Sam?
Very well, thank you.
Ready to tuck into what was a packed weekend and week of football, really.
Absolutely.
And returning, the reason I left him till last is because it's a new voice, or a returning voice to the Squawker Talker podcast, the lean, mean Tom Green machine. How are you?
Good, thanks. How are you guys doing?
All good. Good to be back on, Tom.
It is good.
Are you ready for some spicy Nations League discussion?
And then a good bit of transfer gossip at the end.
Everyone loves transfer gossip. But as I said, we will start with juicy Nations League, which, depending who you are, wasn't as juicy as it was meant to be by UEFA. Obviously, getting rid of friendlies was nice, but I think the fact England went to extra time twice, people were starting to think maybe 60-odd games a season is one game too many. But that didn't stop the man that seems to have infinite stamina, Bernardo Silva, Portugal's player of the tournament for the Nations League. Ronaldo stole the headlines in the semi-final with a hat-trick. And actually, there is a clip of it where Bernardo Silva has been named player of the tournament, where he looks a bit annoyed that the Manchester City midfielder has been given player of the tournament. But well and truly deserved, because of his, again, if Ronaldo had the major impact in the semi-final, Mo, Bernardo Silva's moment of magic pretty much won the game.
I mean, you could argue Bernardo Silva also had a major impact of the semi as well, because it was his pass, a beautiful cutback that Cristiano scored from to make it 2-1, the crucial game-tilting goal. He's just a miraculous footballer. We've been saying it all season. We were saying in the Premier League season, can someone be low-key player of the year? Mm. And it was like, if they can, it's Bernardo Silva. And it's like, can someone be low-key player of the tournament? And honestly, I didn't think they would give it to him. I thought for sure it would be Cristiano. The man got a hat-trick. Maybe Ruben Dias. Portugal looked very solid at the back, only conceded a non-penalty in the semi-final. It was never, I don't know what VAR was thinking with that one. So, you know, they were really good defensively, Portugal. So I thought maybe Ruben Dias, maybe even Semedo. I don't know, but it would never be Bernardo Silva. But they gave it. He was amazing. He's been amazing all season for Man City. Amazing in the cup final. He's got four assists. Sorry, he's got 59 games he played this season, 15 goals, 14 assists, 5 trophies. He's got 4 assists in his last 3 competitive games. 2 in the FA Cup final, 1 in the semi-final against Switzerland, and then 1 in the final last night. And it was a great assist as well. What was so good about it was obviously Gonçalo Guedes nutmegged De Ligt, and Bernardo was running through on goal. And you can see Van Dijk is trying to Sissoko him. He's like, go on, have a shot, mate. I'm there. And Bernardo Silva says, nah, you're all right, son. Waits for Van Dijk to just be staring directly at him and then just pings it. Lovely reverse pass, Guedes is in space. And I was about to say, you know, obviously Guedes took a shot and Citizen should have saved it, but that wasn't even the move. The move was clearly meant to go, Guedes passes over to Cristiano, who's wide open because Daley Blind's come across the cover of Van Dijk, and then Cristiano would have shot and scored. That was like, you can see that was obviously a pre-designed, or at least that's a tactic, that's a sort of a style of attack they use often. And they didn't do that. He shot and he scored anyway, but the brilliance of it all hinging on this amazing ability of Bernardo Silva to sucker in even a defender as good as Van Dijk, and just to be like,
oh. Just a point on that, he didn't really sucker him in, because if the whole narrative about Van Dijk not being dribble pass and stuff has almost flipped the other way, and now everyone's saying, well, it's because he doesn't even go into tackle. And you've said there was almost a Sissoko situation in which he sort of gambled with Bernardo Silva, looked at him, took 2 yards off and said, right, go past me or do what you want. Yeah. And Bernardo Silva, being the magician that he is, didn't need any invitation to be like, okay, I'm just going to cut it back. Yeah. And it almost looked like he contorted his body to cut it back and then Guedes strike. But Van Dijk gave him, I think Carragher pointed it out, it might have been Redknapp or Jamie Carragher, they were both on the Sky Sports, and they were saying, we don't usually say anything about Van Dijk because he's usually flawless, but here maybe he gave Bernardo Silva too much space.
Yeah.
But then I was thinking, Bernardo Silva does that surrounded by five players anyway, so there's almost a lose-lose situation when Bernardo Silva's entered your box already. And as you said, Guedes with a thunderous strike. The Portuguese love a shot, don't they? You're saying that it was meant to be moved on to Cristiano Ronaldo, but Guedes, I remember the Man United Champions League game, he had about eight shots, probably all off target. Bruno Fernandes in this game was trigger happy.
You know what? It wouldn't surprise me if they did a scouting report on Citizen and was like, he's weak to long shots, because the amount of Bruno Fernandes, I mean, I know Bruno Fernandes loves a shot anyway, right? I mean, there's a reason he scored, what was it, 27 goals or something this season. But
30 plus.
You know, but it's like, you can tell they were trying something deliberately. And I think maybe that's also why Guedes shot instead of passing on to Cristiano. When I said he sucked him in, I don't mean necessarily that he pulled him into a challenge. I just mean that he could see that Van Dijk was like, all right, come on, to it. Trying to lock up with him like he did with Sissoko, like daring him to, and he just, like you said, he was like, nah, you're all right.
Well, that's what I mean. Yeah. He was just like, well, I don't need to dribble past you because I'm already in the box. Exactly, I'll cut it back and we'll score.
You know, I don't think it's fair to, I'm not saying Van Dijk made a huge mistake. It's that's his style of defending. It's a really useful, I mean, look, the man made two Champions League finals in a row, 97 points for Liverpool. Whatever you want to say about he doesn't go for tackles, it works, whatever he's doing.
Well, that was the thing. It was, you know, after that match, it's Leroy Sané in the Nations League was the only player to dribble past Van Dijk in 56 appearances across Premier League, Nations League and Champions League. So Bernardo Silva took the right choice because not many people are doing that apart from Sané. But moving forward to the team that were beaten, we're going to touch on their version of Bernardo Silva, perhaps in terms of being one of the great midfielders at the current time. But just look about Netherlands in themselves, Tom. You were saying off air that there's one thing that might stop them, and perhaps did stop them from actually winning that tournament, and could be the reason why they don't go too far in Euro 2020, which it looks like they're going to qualify for.
Yeah, well, there's no two ways about it. Netherlands now have a phenomenal young team in basically every single position. I just still think the position they lack in is that world-class striker. I love Depay. He did really well last season, 10 goals, 10 assists for Lyon in League One. And I know he does play striker sometimes, but he's not a natural striker. He's not Van Persie. He's not a Huntelaar. He's not like a Johan Cruyff. He won't get you those goals he won't necessarily get you those goals you need in the big games, as shown against England, where he had numerous numbers of chances which he kind of squandered. So I just think that's the position they really lack in, and that's what's going to hold them back.
In that England game, he had 10 shots in total, 6 on target, and England only had 3 on target themselves. But then in the reverse, against a resolute Portugal, Netherlands, he was the only player to muster a shot on target, and I agree with you, his finishing, he didn't score in the two games, but it was more his associative play that was beneficial. But they still haven't found that. Babel was starting, Promise was brought on, and Bergwijn was brought on. They still haven't found that matchup in the front three. Sam, do you agree with Tom there?
I just wanted to say, it feels to me like it's a case of what could have been for Vincent Janssen. If you think if he had developed as many predicted, then he could be leading the line. He's definitely in the mould that they need. But moving on to their chances at Euro 2020, I'd definitely say that Netherlands are going to be there or thereabouts. When you look at their team, as Tom said, so De Jong, De Ligt, Van der Beek, with the big moves on the way, they're only going to get better. So it might not feel like it now, but their experience with Ajax, their experience losing to Portugal, is going to stand them in good stead for in a year's time. In the Euros, I'd say you probably only need maybe 2 or 3 standout players to be in with a chance of sort of reaching the latter stages, and they definitely got that. Even though they haven't got the striker, with Van Dijk, who is probably undisputed number one centre-back in the world now, then they're always going to have a chance because they're always going to be able to frustrate the best attacks.
Well, that's the thing. Portugal have shown that you can win tournaments off the back of being absolutely impossible to, or near impossible to score against.
Yeah, but the Euros. Greece as well.
Yeah.
Well, one thing you need, though, even with that, is you need an ability to score goals. And it's not even so much that they don't have a striker. I don't think any of their forwards work together. Like, well, Memphis' associated play is very good and he's great linking everything. But when you need someone who's maybe going to push the defenders back and hold up a little bit, he can't do that. You can see he struggles to, I mean, which is weird because he's got massive thighs, but he can't seem to hold off big, strong defenders. So, I mean, really what they need, I mean, you saw how they improved so much when they brought on Luke de Jong and just like hoofing it to him, because not only is he good in the air, but he's also a good associative player at holding up the ball. I mean, Memphis is a world-class associative player, but with the ball at his feet. I mean, really what they need is either, obviously, I'm not going to switch to 4-2-3-1, but they need to start playing Donny De Beek instead of De Leon. I like De Leon, but I think against the best side, against defensive side, you don't need him there. Against, let's say, England, or someone's going to come at you, maybe he has a purpose, but against a side that's going to sit and defend, you don't need him. And they need to play Memphis maybe on the left, I mean, the left, in air quotes, you know, just basically move him off the front and have an actual striker. I don't know who that is, though. That's the problem.
That's the thing, as Sam alluded to there. You've got Vincent Janssen. Bas Dost has been experimented with, but obviously he's the person that himself said, he scores a lot of bad goals.
Yeah.
So he's very much applying the finishing touch.
Their goals don't necessarily all have to come from the front, though. So England obviously reached the semi-finals, and one of their strongest points was set pieces. I'd say Netherlands in De Ligt and Van Dijk. They've got goals in their team. Their centre-backs can score as well. They might not have goals from the more natural routes, but if they can build a few good set piece plays, then they only need to be scoring 3 or 4 goals.
And that's why Depay's in the team as well, because he was the, Tom sort of alluded to there, in Ligue 1 this season, he created the most chances, and a lot of those were from set pieces, because despite some wayward passes, and I think there were quite a few funny clips of him during this weekend of football, he still is a very technical player, and it was his corner for De Ligt's header, which was another massive header. That's becoming De Ligt's trademark. Those absolutely bulldozing near post corner runs.
Munched John Stones.
Yeah, absolutely destroyed John Stones there. He's now got a Champions League quarterfinal, semi-final goal and a Nations League semi-final goal.
He's a defender. He's incredible. I mean, I've not seen a defender that terrifyingly dominant in the air since Sergio Ramos. Like in big games as well. Like, I mean, obviously defenders can do it in big, but Ramos showed up in big games. De Ligt seems to have that same knack. He's really, really good. Memphis' set piece delivery is brilliant.
Well, this is the thing about De Ligt. So about the aerial duels there, after that semi-final, in which I think he won 4 out of 4 against England, it might have been higher, but I was looking back at his recent performances in semi-finals, and the only person to beat him in the air God, Mo loves sneaking in on my stats. He doesn't let me finish anything.
Sorry.
So it's because he's such an avid, he's got notifications on for when I tweet out, I think. So he knows when they're coming.
Shh, don't tell anyone.
But yes, as I was about to explain, so De Ligt had contested 24 aerial duels in those 3 semi-final appearances, and Llorente had won 5 against him, and it was the only player to do so. But in this final, I can't pinpoint who won the other one, but Bernardo Silva was actually one of the players to beat De Ligt in the air, which just again is just another reason why that Bernardo Silva.
All right,
there we go. That pun was crafted all evening long. Could be in the running himself, because if you think about it, trophies tick. Got plenty of those. International tournament tick, got player of the tournament as well. And is only going to get better this season. No Champions League, but that's what Van Dijk has over him in terms of, if we're talking about these new threats to the Ballon d'Or throne, you've got Lionel Messi, who's again just had the most bonkers individual season. Van Dijk saying he should win it himself. But now you've got these little two new challengers, Van Dijk and Bernardo Silva, emerging. And one player that we haven't touched on that I know Mo was desperate to do as well is, if we've got Matthijs de Ligt there, who we think is going to be, he probably is going to pump up later in our transfer analysis as well. We can dive into that more. But someone that's persuading him to join him at Barcelona is teammate Frenkie de Jong, who in the final wasn't great. I think if we're talking about, he dominated England's midfield in that semi-final, he was very much on the receiving end of a midfield struggle in that final. But that performance against England, which will move us on to what we want to talk about England as well, it just highlighted not only how good he is, but how far off England's composition is maybe at the moment.
Yeah, he's absolutely ridiculous. There was obviously the talk, I think someone branded him the best midfielder in the world before the game.
Yeah,
I think that's a bit too premature, because look, he's amazing and he's definitely one of the best. Like, he's rocketed up the power rankings, if you will, this season with his displays in the Champions League. He's dominated Ajax,
Ajax
against Juventus, against Real Madrid. He's made Pjanic and Kroos and Modric look like amateurs, you know. So he's had a great season. Even Thiago when they played Bayern Munich. So he's dominated really world-class midfielders, and he is one of the best in the world. But as we saw against in the final, in the semi-final, he was amazing. Killed England. I mean, England didn't put out the best midfield in the world, but he still killed them. And frankly, I think any midfielder England would have put out would have gotten a bit mullered. But in the final, what we saw was when his teammates don't help him, it's not, I mean, look, and this is partly just the position he plays. It's hard for him to truly influence the game. He kept Netherlands ticking over. He kept them in possession, kept them moving forward. But he wasn't, until the last 15 minutes of the game, I'll say, he wasn't making enough incisive passes. And so the Dutch weren't necessarily benefiting from his brilliance, because it was mostly a lot of like, okay, I'll give it to Genie Wijnaldum, I'll give it to Memphis, and then they'll do something. And they didn't do anything. So it was like, he kept the Netherlands in possession while he tackled, he prevented Portugal from breaking a lot of times.
He actually got dribble past more times than any player on the pitch, because his tackling, which he always puts in quite a lot of tackles.
Yeah.
And again, that's...
He gets about
a lot, and it's similar into the in Bernardo Silva. I know they play different positions, but similar in that such a technically gifted player actually is being praised more so because of the shift they put in for their team as well. And De Jong, to sort of lean on that as well, he actually did... I think he's one of the most self-aware midfielders, and that's what's going to make him one of the best in the world. Because even after that performance, he's admitted, I could have done more.
Yeah.
There are so many clips of him reviewing his sort of tactics within a single game and giving you a breakdown of exactly what he was told to do, what he did well and what he did wrong. So that self-awareness and that tactical awareness is going to serve him in good stead. And that is what perhaps England are lacking. And I think that was what was shown in both the semi-final and final. I know, Mo, you wrote the piece about England's semi-final problem, didn't you? And it was funny because we had a stream of pictures of ideas for articles and analysis to write that was basically, how did England solve the midfield problem? Sam, you were one of the people to put that idea in. What was the issue, do you think, the main issue about that England midfield, and what's your suggested solution for that, perhaps?
I think we just lacked a bit of creativity in there, a bit of drive. Dele Alli's sort of been out of sorts for the last few games. Mm. And I think, for me, Ruben Loftus-Cheek would have slotted in there really nicely. Obviously, it looks like he's going to be out for a long time now. But I think if England can get him in there, then it's going to solve a lot of the problems that we've had, where we're struggling to link to attack, struggling to drive forwards and make inroads to the final third. We've just been lacking that in the middle there. Another one is Alex Oxlade-Chamberlain.
Yeah.
He could perhaps fill that role as well.
A player that can take it facing their own goal, turn and beat a player to then open them up completely.
Exactly.
What we lack. Because it was in the final, it was Delf, Dyer and Barkley, I think.
Yeah, and I mean...
And it doesn't inspire... Again, Delph is one of those players that, although he doesn't play for Man City, you can understand why he doesn't play for Man City, because they have such an insane squad. But so he sort of almost without thinking, when you see his name, you think, oh...
Mm.
But he's a decent player.
He is good, and he can... And there's a lot to be said for coming in when you haven't played a lot of football and still being able to do a reliable job. But... Especially with Delph and Dyer in there. Dyer is, I would say, sort of clinging on to his place in the England squad. He's going to be in trouble with the sort of, well, if everyone was fully fit, I don't think he would be in the squad. With the likes of Harry Winks, obviously just missed out on this squad, but did end up playing in the Champions League final. Because I think most people now would be putting Winks ahead of Dyer.
Yeah, and then you've got Rice as well, who in the semi-final, again, was criticised slightly for being almost too safe and not having that ability to receive the ball, skip past the player and turn. But again, it's almost... We say, oh, Declan Rice is young and he will improve. Tom, I know you would have watched him a lot. It's almost unfair to... Is it unfair to compare him to like what Frankie de Jong does in that similar role? Do you think Declan Rice has the potential to hold down that spot and give England the platform to play forward?
Not at the moment. I think he's more of just a CDM, not as much a playmaking CDM. He'll win the ball back for you. He'll get the attack started, but he won't necessarily ever make that killer final pass that like breaks over to a defense that other players can do. I'm not necessarily saying that he will never be able to do that. I'm just saying at the moment, from what I saw at West Ham, he didn't really do that last year. And again, he didn't really do that for England. which may be something that Pellegrini will look at and want to work with next season. So we could see it in his game soon, but...
Yeah, I think that's... If you look at it, right, we had... At the World Cup, we had Dyer and Henderson. Henderson was the wall-playing option. Dyer was the defensive option, right? I think now you can... Henderson will stay around because he's obviously a great leader and a great influential figure, but you can just chuck Dyer out of the squad now because Rice does what Dyer does, but better. Right, and you look at it really. You got Dyer is your defensive guy, right? So when you want to go defensive, he's your defensive midfielder. And then you've got Loftus-Cheek. I mean, hopefully he comes back from injury fine because he's such a special player. Loftus-Cheek, Oxlade-Chamberlain, maybe even Dele or Jesse Lingard. When you want to go offensive, right? But what you need is these are two alternate players. What you want is two mainstays, right? And that's you need guys who can do everything. So you mentioned Harry Winks, right? 61.1 passes per 90 minutes in the last two Champions League seasons for Spurs. That's more than any of the rest of their players. And 91.1% accuracy, again, more than any of their players. He's a pass machine, right? He has to be a mainstay. He has to play every single game, unless it's obviously a friendly or whatever. He has to be the guy, give him the number 6 or the number 8 or whatever, 4, I don't know. But just he has to be the mainstay. And the other one is James Maddison. I think you look at Maddison, what he can bring to England is he can play on the break. So if England want to play on the break, he can do that. If England want to play possession football, he can do that. And what he also brings in, and which is something that you would worry about England losing if you're not got Trippier in the side anymore, is set pieces.
Oh, yeah. Well.
48, I mean, I know you've got Trent as well, but because Trent isn't necessarily 100%, I think, locked on, because Walker has a lot of experience and a lot of quality. And again, if you're playing a really top class. I know there was Martin Tyler got pilloried for saying, is he ready for international football? And of course, that's an absurd thing to say because he just played in the Champions League final. Two Champions League finals back to back. But he was playing with Virgil van Dijk. England don't have Virgil van Dijk. I mean, Harry Maguire's good, but he's not quite Virgil van Dijk. And Trent, there is a concern over Trent's defending. That's why Jurgen Klopp didn't play him at the Camp Nou against Barcelona. Because even now, as good as he is attacking, and he is, and we'll get onto him in a minute, but you know, there's a defensive weakness there, and England do not have a defender anywhere close to Virgil van Dijk to cover for him. So maybe you won't have Trent on the side, so maybe you won't have set pieces, but Maddison will give you constant set pieces. You got 48 chances created from set pieces this season, which is more than anyone else in the Premier League. 100 chances created overall.
Yep.
Maddison and Winks for me are the guys. And then if you're going defensive, you bring Rice in for the three. If you're going a bit more offensive, Winks goes to the base and you play Maddison and then either Loftus-Cheek or Dele Alli or Jesse Lingard or something, just to get a bit more, or even Henderson, frankly.
I was going to say, Henderson's probably going to be, again, Champions League winning captain. You maybe keep him around, at least for Euro 2020, in terms of that leadership.
Yeah, I'm thinking 2022, though. But yeah.
Well, we got 2020 first.
That's
true. We can't do 2020 Netherlands and then 2022 England.
That's
but
true.
I agree in the sense that Maddison, I think Gareth Southgate said on a couple of occasions that he wasn't picked because he's not picking number 10s. Or England don't play with a number 10, which seems to be not the excuse, but seems to be ruining a lot of players' careers at the moment in the fact that no one plays with a number 10. But Maddison at Leicester now, with Rodgers tweaking that system, Maddison will start playing in that number 8-ish role, a bit more reserved in a midfield three with Ndidi and then potentially Tielemann if they can keep hold of Tielemann. But I think next season will be the season in which if James Maddison isn't getting called up to England, then there's something really odd because he's going to start proving himself in that position.
Might end up at Man United.
But then I still think there's big question marks over Maddison about stepping up to international level. I don't think we can say that he's definitely going to come in and sort of solve the problem when he's uncapped. He's still got a lot of work.
Of course, and that's what I mean. This season, if he plays that role in which he will be the main hub of football from a deeper area, and as Mo said, show that he can play on the break, but show that he can start controlling games, because England have a lot of neat people and creative players. They're just not the players that are creative in the sense that absorb the ball and dictate a game. There's a slight difference there that we're lacking in the sense that Frenkie de Jong, as Mo mentioned, against Real Madrid and against Juventus, dictated the game and played it to his level. England don't have a midfielder that puts their foot on the ball and says, I'm going to play at this pace now. It seems very rushed and panicky sometimes, which can be good if we want to play complete counter-attacking football. But even that looked a bit rusty this time around. So Trent's, although it was 0-0, and obviously we have Jordan Pickford again in a penalty shootout to thank, I guess, after a
big man Jordan,
an incredible fifth penalty and then saving it again. But the only thing in that game that was really exciting for England was Alexander-Arnold, who created 7 chances, which was more than any player any England player in the entire Nations League tournament in that one game. And again, a lot of it was crossing. Raheem Sterling missed quite a few chances. I was ready for another resurgence of the narrative that he cannot finish, because again, he had a bad day at the office in front of goal. But it looks like England, for the positives of Trent Alexander-Arnold and stuff, the one final thing we're going to touch on is the centre-back partnership. And Mo, you said there that if the midfield needs to be more creative and Alexander-Arnold perhaps is too close to being the creative hub, but not good defensively, and doesn't have Van Dijk to back him up, you're not going to rely on Trent Alexander-Arnold with John Stones in his current state. And as myself being a fan of John Stones, remember it was his goal line clearance that essentially won Man City the league in 2018-19 with that clearance. He still has the capability to be a good defender, but another mistake, and Joe Gomez stepping in and looking absolutely class, which he does whenever he plays,
he's brilliant.
Tom, is this the end of John Stones in an England shirt and potentially even Man City shirt?
I don't think so. And going back to what you said about the mistake he made, I actually thought it was quite interesting what Gary Neville said after the game, which was that at full time after the 90 minutes, he said that Gareth Southgate probably said to the players that we are being too safe and playing back to the keeper on too many occasions. So I reckon John Stones, who probably knew that he wasn't having the greatest of games at the time, received the ball then, and in his mind, he remembered those words, I can't really pass back to the goalkeeper, and then kind of panicked, and that's why he lost the ball, which again is, he still made the mistake, and it's still, but I think the bit of sympathy there, because I think what Gary Neville said was right, that Gareth Southgate did say, look, we need to stop passing back.
And because blimmin' Declan Rice wasn't giving him a good option in midfield.
Yeah, that was the thing. There wasn't any good passing lanes for him in midfield, but the easy pass wasn't. This is the thing with John Stones. He's a really, really good player. Technically fantastic. Loads of potential. He's 25 now?
Yeah.
He's got to stop cutting out. These mistakes have to start going out of his game. It's understandable when you're a young defender. It's even understandable when you're even 22, 23, if you're not playing necessarily a stable defensive system. And remember, I mean, we did play for City before when they won the title. He had a lot of different partners. It was Kompany, it was Otamendi, whatever. Now Laporte's come in. Laporte's the guy. And Laporte and Stones is objectively a great partnership. They cover a lot of bases. There's no real weakness there, objectively, except the fact that Stones just can't seem to... he just seems... There's always a mistake in him. Mm. And unlike Kompany, who's always a mistake in Kompany as well, even when he was in his prime, there's no sort of assurance that you think he'll get over it. Like Stones is a phenomenal defender, but it just... I really want him to be England's guy, because I think he's so talented and he's so able of doing it, but it just seems like he needs a bit too much protection right now. I don't know what needs to change for that. Maybe he just needs to be City's starter next to Laporte for an entire season undisputed. I don't know. I think he'll be fine with City, because I don't think City are going to go spend like... crazy amount of centre-back.
Well, this is the thing. The point that was highlighted was that, and you mentioned it as well, Sam, is that De Ligt, who's 19, and be reminded that De Ligt makes a mistake a game,
yeah.
I think.
Yeah.
If you actually watch De Ligt's game, he makes a lot of errors, got skinned for that Portugal goal, and charges out a lot. But you would say that at 19, you hope that's going to disappear. So he's got time on his side. John Stones, 6 years his senior, which when you say it like that, that's six years is a lot of time to cut out those mistakes. De Ligt was the one that absolutely demolished John Stones for that corner. Yeah. And that, perhaps that lack of, if you're saying Kompany has those mistakes, Kompany would go through absolutely anyone and everything to win the ball.
De Ligt is the same.
John Stones perhaps doesn't have that. And that is what is potentially going to...
I think he's probably entitled to be a bit rusty though after he started. So just 3 league fixtures since mid-February, and his longest run of 90-minute performances back-to-back was just 3 last season. So... yeah, I mean, Guardiola clearly doesn't quite fancy him, because as Mo says, he does always look like he has a mistake in him.
Mm.
But I think it's a bit too early to be writing him off completely. Obviously, Southgate's picked him despite the fact he hasn't played a lot this season. And Guardiola's been really bullish in his defence of John Stones when he has been sort of pulled up on that. But then he's getting into a sort of catch-22 situation. Because if Pep sort of says to him, right, you're going to be number 3 or 4 in the centre-back pecking order, then inevitably he will lose his place at international level. Yeah. Because, I mean, Southgate not so long ago said that he wasn't going to be picking players who aren't playing for the club. Yeah. So he hasn't been playing for his club, but he's still got picked. There's only so much credit he's going to have left.
But let's see what happens with Joe Gomez, though, about that as well. Because is he going to... I mean, you would think he will displace John Matip because he's a better defender or certainly has more potential. But will he? That's going to be... Because I think Klopp is very high on Matip, especially...
Matip had a great season.
I mean, it's the same thing. It's about having the credit, isn't it? Like, Matip, can you really drop him after having... Yeah. Such a good end to the season for Gomez.
But then remember Gomez's start, and that's the thing. It's like, so if we're talking about credit, Joe Gomez still has the credit for his incredible start. And Matip, was an able deputy, but perhaps the pecking order was always, if Gomez is fit, Gomez plays.
It's the same old thing with international football, though. So now, for the next however many months it is until England play, everyone is going to have a cross again, next to Stones' name, and Gomez is going to have a big tick because he's played. So that's fresh in your memory, isn't it?
I wonder, is there a third way? Is there someone who actually is starting?
It would be the likes of sort of Lewis Duncan and players like that.
To be fair, I do think John Stones will start for City because I don't see them going out into the centre-back market is ferocious right now. Like, I mean, I don't think City are going to enter that. I think they've got Otamendi as a backup. They've got Laporte, obviously, as nailed on starter. They might go out and sign some youngish player. Maybe they'll promote Eric Garcia from the Youth Academy to replace Kompany. I think this season is the make or break for Stones. I think if he can come through this season as the starting player and avoid injuries, because injuries have done him in the past, like derailed him when he had momentum, then I think he'll take off. He'll absolutely take off. If he has a rough season again, I think it's game over at the top level. I think.
And just a word on his partner in crime, Maguire, who in the final showed that England weren't going to shy away from turning with the ball in their box. Which was, as we said, we discussed Maguire's dribbling ability before. So if we want players to turn out from the back, just give it to Harry Maguire and let him move those dancing feet. but that was the back three was always, I quite liked the idea of having Gomez, Stones and Maguire as a back three. But moving away from that, it looks like it's only going to be two of those three in the future. But we will see. And we'll wrap up our Nations League review right there. And after a quick break, we'll be diving into some more international football. So in a summer full of international tournaments, we're moving on for the Nations League. That is done and dusted. But one that will be going for another month at least is the Women's World Cup. And we're going to start with France, the hosts. Obviously, at the time of recording, there'll be games on straight after us and there'll be games on week. So we don't want to dwell too much on what it means for each group, as what we say might be proved completely irrelevant by the time you hear it. But we can talk about the French team and obviously... one of the favourites with Lyon dominating the Champions League at club level. It seems like France were finally given the platform to make a real go at the Women's World Cup. And 4-0 in their opening game. And they looked an absolute class above South Korea.
It could have been 4-0 in the opening 10 minutes. This was absolute devastation. Second half, South Korea came out and they were a bit more organised and everything. But that first half was an almighty beatdown. You know, every single player for France was just looked untouchable. You know, Cascarino was carrying it brilliantly.
Yeah, Cascarino, I was really impressed. She posted 5 take-ons completed in that game.
Well, we'll go on to
what
that is.
Well, exactly, that's what I mean. But she was later to be blown away.
Yeah, and she was great, carrying the ball excellently. Henry was just, I mean, the goal was great, really nice. But this performance was just all energy, all drive, just really pushed the team forward. Les Omeris, I mean... It was only one goal she scored in the end, but I mean, she's what is that, 75 and 160 caps? That's pretty impressive. 223 and 249 for Lyon. I mean, you know, you can see why Lyon are winning everything with her and Hegerberg up front and Wendy Reynard in defence. I mean, that's the one. I've been a fan of Wendy Reynard for literally like over 5 years now. Just because when I first watched, I was like, oh my god, she's really really massive, which makes her stand out. Yeah. And then you watch her and it's like, going forward, she's so good. Those crossfield passes are amazing. She just slings the thing across the pitch for fun. And she's so dominant in the air going forward. And she's so comfortable stepping forward as well. She's not a bad defender as well while you're at it. But
Well, that was the main thing was obviously everyone drawn to it. And as well, myself, I've not followed women's football for since the start of time. So a lot of this stuff in the World Cup, I'm trying to dive in as much as possible. But obviously when you watch Wendy Renard, the first thing you're drawn to is that size. But it's actually the ability to win a header is one thing, but to direct it, drop it down for another player, the genuine technique that she has in the air is, she won all four of her aerial duels in that game, unsurprisingly.
But it's like you said, it's not just winning it, it's doing something with it as well. It's like the headed assist. I mean, that's a rare skill, you know. Then that's like Kevin Davies could do it, but I mean, she's bigger than Kevin Davies. It's just, well, she headed it across the, and it's a real shame that got ruled out by the Bob Bathy's volley. That was a lovely goal. But she got, you know, Wendy Renard eventually got her brace in the end. I mean, honestly, I thought she'd get a hat trick. I'm surprised she didn't, to be honest. Like, I'm surprised that the set pieces just sort of dried up a little bit. But I think, honestly, once they got to 4-0, they were like, let's just ride this out. Let's not overextend ourselves. We've got a much bigger test coming.
Well, that's the thing. If France are one of the favourites, obviously Norway are sharing the group with France. Yeah. And a lot of the talk, obviously you can't sort of talk about the Women's World Cup being thrown into the public eye and getting real incredible viewing figures already. Yeah. And obviously a lot of the talk about Norway is with Ada Hedenberg, who's literally scoring more goals than she's playing games. So to not have her at the World Cup is a major talking point. Martin Odegaard recently came out from the Norway's men's teams and had his say on the matter. There is very much controversy and it's leaving a bit of a sour taste that it is discussed so much, but it looks like they're not even going to need her.
I mean,
because that 3-0 win, obviously it was a first half blitz really against Nigeria, who unfortunately have lost the most games in the history of the Women's World Cup.
Yeah.
So it didn't look like they were going to get a win, but it was one particular player that is also going to Barcelona this summer, that you made quite a nice comparison with in your post-match article for that game,
mate. Yes, if Frankie de Jong is going to Barcelona and set the world alight, then Caroline Graham Hansen is wow. Like, if you watched her, it was quite, it's probably the most, for me, it's the most spectacular individual performance so far at the World Cup. Obviously, didn't score, only got one assist, but just the way she was dribbling past literally everyone, it was just, she'd get the ball, she would just stop for a second and let someone come towards her, then just blow by them. She was incredible. She posted, she attempted 13 take-ons, completed 9 of them, both of them competition highs.
Yeah.
Just, oh my God, 9 take-ons completed in the opening game of the World Cup. Just unreal. Nigeria actually started the game very brightly, actually, just to mention that. And they had they really, really went for it, and they were attacking down the flanks, and they looked like they were going to do something. Franny was just spectacular on the right wing. You're thinking, okay, here we go. And then what happened was they've got a 36-year-old Onome Eddy in defence, and she was just culpable for all three of the goals. Like, it's one of those things, you know, we're going to talk about an experienced player in a minute who's got 7 World Cups. This was her 6th World Cup, and she wasn't very good. Like, she was made these big mistakes, and Norway punished, man. Norway were so ruthless and efficient. But Graham Hansen was just, it was unreal watching it, because it's so good. I mean, we've all watched Eden Hazard all seasons, and we delighted up. A player who can dribble is always a player worth watching.
And that's what we're saying England lack as well.
Yeah. I mean, you know, you watch the way she takes players on, and you wonder what could happen if Ada Hegerberg had come to the World Cup. Now, just briefly on her stand that she's taking is entirely justified. And, you know, her argument is, of course, that the fact that the women's team in Norway is not taken as seriously, not given as much prestige as the men's team, despite the fact that the men's team is a bit of a joke. And the women's team, they won the World Cup. They won 2 Euros. They won, they won just about everything there is going. They're one of the best teams in the world, Norway's women's team. And they've never been given their due. So you have to say, really, it's a moral stand. It's a stand worth taking, because it doesn't just affect Norway and her, but it'll have wider reaching consequences. This is the best player in the world, bar none, taking, Ada Hegerberg is basically Cristiano Ronaldo and Lionel Messi in one player. Like, just to summarize, she's just phenomenal, and she's so much better than everyone else, even despite that there's loads of great talent like Wendy Renard and Graham Hansen and everything. But she's brilliant, and she's decided morally I have to take a stand, and that's huge. I think that's commendable, and we should just, you know, not like...
Yeah, so to clarify my comments at the beginning, I wasn't saying that it wasn't worthwhile. I was just saying that
you can't.
Again,
no,
I always enjoy trying to focus on the football as much as possible. Because, seeing take-ons are the first that I look for in anything. And throughout the World Cup, I've been trying to find my new favourite player by looking at who is completing the most take-ons. Obviously, in the first game, as you said, we had Cascarino for France, who was brilliant on the right wing. And the overlaps and that France were manipulating, winning the ball so high up against South Korea and then just manoeuvring it for cutbacks and, yeah. and shots on target was great to see. But then, yeah, Hansen coming in and posting nine. And it was even for the first goal where they took the short corner and yeah, it was just like, give the short corner, give it back. I'm just going to weave into the box, yeah. cut it back for you. It was deflected into the goal. But as you said, the ability to take the ball past someone is so valuable, especially when it seems like the counter-attacking teams, and I've been... there are a lot of people, obviously, that know everything about the women's game. And I'm seeing a lot of comments about the fact that before, because of the disparity and the fact that you still have some people that aren't professional players playing in this tournament anyway, but the step up is shown by the fact that the counterattack is now more dangerous than ever. Before, if you were the better team at the Women's World Cup, you would win. Now, as we saw with Italy, who aren't necessarily underdogs, but the ability to punish the better teams out of possession has been improved by an increased level of fitness, which is again improved by the fact you are a professional team and being given the proper financial support. So this World Cup will open up the similarity with the men's game that we've talked about, in the sense that possession now, it's about what you do when you're out of it and how quickly you can punish an opposition team. The likes of France and Norway look like they're going to have to step it up to do that, especially when you said you've got Renard waiting at the back. But moving on from that group and potential two favourites there of the tournament or looking to make a real dent in it, we'll move on to Phil Neville's England side. Obviously getting a first win and again, something that communicates how far the women's game has come in just within 2 years. In 2017 at the European Championships, England beat Scotland 6-0. It was 2-1 this week. And although Nikita Paris was herself trying to become my favourite player with some outrageous nutmegs, and obviously she's joining Lyon after becoming the women's Super League top scorer of all time, she'll be moving to Lyon. But that right side now, she'll be linking up with Lucy Bronze again at Lyon. Do England have a chance after seeing how talented that France squad is? Are England on that level, or was the 2-1 a sign that there's still plenty more to come from that England side?
I think you'd have to say they're definitely contenders. They've reached at least the quarterfinal stage in the previous four tournament appearances, so they're in the ballpark. Their performance against Scotland was not incredible, although they did have a good first half and it tailed off, but it really doesn't matter at this stage. They've got 3 points in the bag now. It's banked. They can face Argentina now, and if they get another result, and they're through. There are a few nerves on show in Neville's team, which is to be expected, really. I think he's got 11 debutants in the squad. And Paris herself even said that she sat in the hotel room before and had butterflies and was sort of thinking, right, this is it now. I have to perform. And obviously she did. Southgate got quite a bit of flack in the tournament build-up, where he sort of chopped and changed his team.
do you mean Phil Neville?
Who did I say?
You said Southgate. I think you've been swayed by the which is obviously the official World Cup manager's attire, full on waistcoat.
But yeah, so I think Neville got it right here. And I would say Duggan's a comeback in probably for Mead, and England are looking good. You touched on Paris there. Her partnership with Bronze, I'd say, is the best partnership we've seen in the tournament so far.
Yeah, Harry Edwards, who covered that game for Scorecard, put in his article that there might not be a better right-hand side at the World Cup, which, again, will be tested. France themselves had a pretty mean right wing and left wing and centre forward. So England will come up against stronger tests. But as you said, to get that first win on the board, and that's only the second time that they've won their opening game at a World Cup. The last time was in 1995. So England's starting, how they often haven't started in recent tournaments, is only surely a positive for Phil Neville to, as you said, Sam, to build upon.
Yeah, definitely. I was just so impressed with that Paris-Bronze partnership. Paris, she's the sort of player that you pay your admission for. Mm. So exciting. And Bronze, so she's been at Lyon. Obviously, you mentioned Paris is going to be joining her at Lyon. That's going to be one hell of a partnership.
Paris and Lyon.
So Bronze, 27, Ballon d'Or nominee. So accomplished on the ball. It really feels like it is her time. But I was a bit surprised that Scotland didn't sort of react to the fact that they were giving Nicola Docherty such a tough time, because all the players going down that side, but Scotland seemed intent to continue playing down that side themselves. But one sort of small negative, I would say, from that partnership was that Fran Kirby really struggled to get into the game. With everything going down that right-hand side, she wasn't at her best. Mm. And I think that could potentially be a bit of a problem in the latter stage of the tournament if it's almost an over-reliance on that partnership. Because like you say, if they come against someone who can handle Paris and Bronze, then England need to have more up their sleeve.
And perhaps they're waiting for, if it's working and they get so much joy with that partnership, perhaps he does have something up his sleeve for that, and we're just yet to see it.
True.
But beyond England as well, and as I said, there were plenty of other stories throughout what is sort of not even the completed first round of fixtures just yet. But the last theme that we wanted to touch on was Brazil, because it's quite extraordinary that Formiga became the oldest player at a World Cup at 41 years of age. But she is the first player to feature in 7 World Cup tournaments, and that's man or woman. That is quite an unbelievable achievement, really, at 41 years of age. And then it was her striker for Brazil, who at 34 years old became the oldest player to score a World Cup hat-trick, again, male or female. Cristiano Ronaldo is the oldest in the male tournament, so something about Christian there. I saw a lot of people punning that. There's something in that name that means that you will score hat-tricks and you'll do it when you're in your 30s. But Brazil, obviously, they'd come into this World Cup losing 9 games.
Yeah,
there was complete concern that...
Injuries too, big injuries as well in the day of the tournament.
I think playing just two warm-up games as well.
Yeah, so they were fully underprepared, it seemed, and you were scared that potentially it would unravel. As we said, Marta didn't play in the first game because she's injured, is looking to become one of the... There's a select few players that can be the first to score in 5 World Cups. She's looking to do that, but obviously is not fit. And so with an ageing squad, with a 41-year-old midfielder, who, by the way, was still steaming around and looking to win every single tackle, Brazil would have been more relieved than anyone to get that sort of 3-0 out of the way.
I mean, and Jessé Alves was just... in Marta's absence, she stepped up big time. She was just absolutely phenomenal. One of the stars of Nike's pre-tournament advert. She's the one in the Brazil shirt, if you're wondering. Actually, it's funny because in the advert, I think she so far has had the best performance. As is Ashuala, who also didn't play too well. So she's really been the star so far from that advert. But she was great. 6 chances created, which is the most in the tournament so far. 2 assists. Really, really, the only assist she didn't get was for the Brazil's dead ball goal. Yeah, the free kick. She was, her movement was excellent. The way she drifted in off the left flank, cutting it onto her left foot and played these really, really raking passes, was just constantly keeping Brazil on the front foot, putting them in dangerous positions to hurt Jamaica. Obviously, she also missed a penalty. Let's not forget that. She had quite an afternoon, really. Missed a penalty. It wasn't a good penalty. Mm. Although maybe she was... it's one of those ones where if the keeper guesses the wrong way, you're fine. It'll go in. But if he guesses right, then you've not hit it hard enough and it's not going to go. But, didn't let it get her down. Continued to play brilliantly. 2 assists. Most of the tournament so far. She's stepping up big time. I think if they can add Marta... If you can bring Marta in and just sort of keep Andres Alves playing at this level, but also add Marta and everything she can bring, they could be something.
And just to shout for Jamaica, they're obviously the first Caribbean side to feature in a Women's World Cup as well. And Sydney Schneider in goal, who was absolutely peppered, she's only 19 years old and still at college. So again, if we're talking about this, how there's still way more development to come, we've got Matthijs de Ligt playing for Netherlands, full-on professional at 19 years of age. Jamaica have called up a college goalkeeper who, despite conceding 3 goals, put on an incredible performance. And even Usain Bolt was getting behind her. So all eyes on the reggae girls, as they are known so far. But Sam, you just had raise your hand there for maybe another extra point on Brazil.
Yeah, I just wanted to touch on the sort of Marta narrative that it's been a bit doom and gloom because she's been out. And obviously her record is incredible. 133 caps, 110 goals, and she's 33. But then as we touched on Christiane, 34. She's got 93 goals in 138 caps. So she's probably felt like her whole career that she's been in Marta's shadow. So to sort of have the opportunity to step out of it and sort of say, well, she could potentially get her 100 goal, clock up 100 goals in the tournament. So
yeah, she'd need a big haul. Well, Marta's the top scoring woman at World Cup tournaments with 15, and Christiane became only the second Brazilian player to move to double figures with that hat trick. So as you said, there are plenty of, as the polar end of the spectrum there, you've got a 19-year-old goalkeeper representing Caribbean nation for the first time ever. And on the other end, you have a 34-year-old striker who throughout her career has not only been living in Marta's shadow, but more sort of politically and beyond the world of football. Brazil's women, and I read an article from Brenda Elsie on that was published on SB Nation that just gives a complete insight into the misogyny, really, of Brazilian football and how the struggle for women to make it in that game, where in a country in which still almost prehistoric views about if you play and you, if you play football, you have muscles, then you're more a man than you are a woman, and stuff like that we just don't need in the world right now. They've fought against that, and to come through all of that and then score so many goals and get a hat-trick at the World Cup was just a really good moment. And hopefully that's something that, if Brazil can have success at this World Cup, propels them to make some changes back home, which seems unlikely, but you hope something like that has the power to do so. And with so many people watching and already being mesmerised by obviously six chances created and the talent in that Brazil team, hopefully there is change that can be made from that. But we will leave Women's World Cup talk there for this week. And the final part of the Squawker Talker will be a Squawker Scout on some of the transfers that you may have already seen and that may be coming up. So that music only means one thing, as you know, it's Squawker Scout, and we're going to dive into the transfers. And the biggest transfer that happened in the week is obviously the £88 million move. Finally, Eden Hazard going from the Blues to Los Blancos. And Real Madrid obviously already signing Luka Jovic and planning to sign Ferland Mendy. It looks like the Zinedine Zidane real rebuild is well and truly underway. But the question remains, Mo, is what do they do with all these players coming in?
I mean, first things first, we have to credit Marina Granovskaya, really, for getting 100 million euros for a player who's got 1 year left on his contract. That's a 28-year-old who's got 1 year left on his deal. That's impressive. That's very impressive. Secondly, for Real Madrid, this is huge. Like, I mean, Real Madrid have wanted Eden Hazard for, I mean, as long as I can remember, Zinedine Zidane is a massive fan of his. Florentino Perez loves him as well. But of course, for years, they had that left wing berth kind of sewn up with a certain someone. And that certain someone's not there anymore. And so now, I'm sure one of the big conditions of Zidane returning was, we're going to get Eden Hazard. That's my boy. I want him there. And he's so very Real Madrid. I've never seen a more perfect player. I mean, we had two of them this year. Frenkie de Jong, Barcelona, that's perfect. Eden Hazard, Real Madrid, that's also perfect. He'll sleep through a couple of games, three games, four games, and then he'll absolutely be lightning in a bottle for four games in a row. Just like unplayable, world-breaking level. He'll probably help them win the Champions League again. Like, he's perfect for the Champions League, isn't he? Just sack off Ibar away, mate. Just wait for Man United. Well, not Man United, good Lord. Wait for Man City away, or wait for Liverpool at home. He'll be amazing. He's a big game player, great dribbler, 98 chances created in the Premier League. He's going to fit in well with Luka Jovic, who scores goals for fun, but isn't necessarily what you would call it. He's not like Karim Benzema. Benzema's a very all-everything forward. He's a great creator, great dribbler, great hold-up player. Jovic can dribble. Jovic can run with the ball. He's not he's not Piatek. He's not Christoph Piatek, but he is very much a goal scorer. If you watch his, you watch him play, you watch his goals especially, he's in the box, he gets the ball, and he comes to life. And what have Real Madrid needed, especially this last season, is a player who does exactly that. You play him in a...
So this is the thing. So yeah, you've got all these parts. Obviously, Benzema's coming off a season where, despite it being mostly at the latter end of the season, got a big goal tally once again. So he proved that he can still score. But now you bring in Luka Jovic, who, as you said, is pretty much only going to play number nine.
Yeah.
And then Eden Hazard. Do you play... Are those three going to be playing up front? How is this Real Madrid team now going to set up with the introduction of Hazard?
I mean, they have options. They could go 4-3-3 and sign someone and play Asensio on the wing or something. They can play Gareth Bale. I think they'll go back to the diamond. And I think they'll put Hazard as a number 10. Because I think one thing he's always said, very spoken, very openly about, is, I want to play number 10. And that makes sense as well, because one of the big problems...
He does describe himself as a winger, though.
Well, yeah, I think what he means is he just wants to be the guy who can run where he wants. I think that's what we saw with Chelsea, is he wants to run where he wants. And the best way to do that for an attacking player is to just say, you can be number 10. That doesn't mean necessarily he's going to play in the middle of the pitch all the time. If you saw the way Isco played that diamond, he often drifted to the left as well. Mm. The point is, defensively, you are not responsible for a fullback. That's the point of playing as a number 10. What Real Madrid's diamond was before with Cristiano, Benzema and Isco, I think that's what we'll have now with Benzema, Jovic and Eden Hazard. Eden Hazard will be the creative guy, complete freedom to go wherever he wants, no defensive responsibility, which is very key for him, because I don't think he particularly cares for defending. I mean, he'll do it, but I don't think he particularly enjoys it.
Benzema, who does?
Well,
yeah, no, that's a joke.
Bernardo Silva, I guess.
Yeah.
Frankie de Jong, sorry, Frank, and he enjoys it as well. You know, you look at Benzema's going to be the link man again, but I do think he'll get more chances to score and be a bit of a lead guy. But Jovic is perfect. And you look at the way Jovic is, talk about him as like a pure number nine, but if you look at him for Frankfurt, he wasn't usually the number nine, the target guy. That was Haller, Sebastian Haller, who was very important. 12 assists, I think. I don't think anyone in the Bundesliga, only two people in the Bundesliga had more. He's really a creative player, and you can see exactly how Haller and Jovic can be replicated with Benzema and...
Well, these Barcelona slips are more prominent than usual, mate.
With Benzema and Jovic, you can see exactly how that works. And I think it's almost a match made in heaven. The only thing is Benzema going to be happy to once again being the link guy?
I think Benzema, when it's someone that Hazard's coming in...
Hazard will be amazing. But I mean, because we... Again, just
no, but this is what I mean. Benzema will enjoy being... Benzema is a very much, as we said... As we always say, and everyone says about him and all of his teammates, and their whole propaganda drive is that he's a number 10 with a number 9 on his back.
Yeah.
So this is a chance where he gets to almost be a dual number 10 with Hazard, and then piling all the goal scoring responsibility onto Jovic.
Oh, I mean, look, it's going to be... This is the thing. We talk about Eden Hazard and Olivier Giroud. This is Eden Hazard and Olivier Giroud times 10.
Exactly. So Hazard gets... Expect a lot of 1-2s in and around the box.
Oh, so many flick-ons.
Which will be great to see. But with spending so much money, this surely means that there is also going to be an equally large clear out at Real Madrid. And obviously, James Rodriguez is one of those players who said to Bayern, please don't sign me. I want to go back. 2-year loan spell, obviously two titles. But James Rodriguez is technically now, again, a Real Madrid player. It does not look like he will stay there. One, because... he wouldn't have been loaned out in the first place. And two, because they've just signed Hazard and they need to sell someone. James Rodriguez should still command a decent fee, Tom. Where can you see the Colombian playmaker actually making or reviving his career, if you will, in this summer, if anyone's going to take him at all?
Mate, I'm back in. I think James Rodriguez will be... dependent upon potentially another deal, which is Eriksen out of Tottenham. And I think potentially if Eriksen does go to Real Madrid or Barcelona, then James Rodriguez could be a potential fit at Tottenham as a like-for-like replacement.
So you think James making his way to the Premier League, which has been wished upon? There were plenty of rumours linking Arsenal, as despite Mesut Ozil still being in the squad, Arsenal hunting for James Rodriguez. You think the Colombian is going to be in North London? Yeah.
Well, I mean, they just got to the Champions League final. They've got this massive new stadium. They should potentially have money to spend, especially if they get rid of Eriksen as well.
Well, Eriksen came out and said, didn't he, that he might be the time for a new challenge. And if it is Real Madrid, then it would be a step up, but they just need to pick up the phone. So if they pick up the phone, some sort of Daniel Levy masterclass, swap Eriksen and
I mean, it's kind of like a like-for-like replacement, because they are both creative players, both cams. They can both pick out that finer killer ball. So I think that would be a great move for James Rodriguez as well, getting to play in the Premier League.
James is way more box office than Eriksen as well. as good as Eriksen is, and he's great. James is so box office. Imagine him as Spurs is. I mean, he wouldn't get the number 10.
But
obviously,
that's kind of what Tottenham need as well. A big name signing like that, which should push them on to the next level, hypothetically. Maybe. Especially after the season they've just had.
Keep Pochettino sweet by bringing in some South American flair to go with his South American fire. But another player that Real Madrid will have to be moving on, as well as James probably, is Gareth Bale, who We knew he had a long throw, but
because
he used it for Spurs a couple of times. But if anyone hasn't seen it, and there had people saying that apparently, I don't know if it was eventually called out for being a foul throw, but I don't care because he's managed to throw a ball from the halfway line into the opposition box. And Harry Wilson, who himself will be the subject of much transfer rumour this summer, decided to miss. But Gareth Bale and his long throw looks like Real Madrid want him out, but it very much looks like he's willing to stay. And I think a lot of the quotes that have been said about him and how blasé he's been about staying are perhaps not bang on. But if you were Gareth Bale, you'd want to stay at Real Madrid, I guess. The success he's had there. Do you see there have been obviously talks with him going to coming back to Spurs, perhaps out of their price range, but we don't expect James Rodriguez and Gareth Bale to be Spurs' new signings this summer, especially as Lucas Moura is the last player they have actually signed. But what do you think is in store for Gareth Bale this summer, Sam?
It's not looking particularly great for him, is it? I mean, Zidane's been pretty ruthless. If Bale does stay, then I can't see him getting much game time. By all accounts, he's dug his heels in and said, I'm happy to stay. Mm. Like you said, why wouldn't you? He's got an absolutely ridiculous contract.
Mm.
And what Mo touched on earlier, Zidane, I don't think he would have returned to take over if he didn't have these assurances about how he was going, the direction he was going to be allowed to take the team in. And I think Bale's future hinged on his decision to come back. So he's obviously set his stall out. I mean, not allowing him the potential farewell appearance.
Yeah.
So it's a huge risk for Zidane to say, I'm just going to leave you sitting on the bench or not putting him in the squad at all. But the problem then that Bale has is, where does he go?
Yeah.
Madrid don't want to lose face because he would still command a decent fee, but they don't want to lose face for selling him on the cheap. But he represents such a short-term gain, especially for Premier League clubs. So if you think back to when he was there, he was at Spurs. He was the player in the league. He was the guy that neutral fans would watch Spurs games because Bale was playing. So I think he's got a lot to lose if he comes back to the Premier League.
Definitely.
and is not instantly that box office top three players in the league, because that's what everyone would expect him to be.
Yeah.
If he came back and didn't quite hit those heights,
the nostalgia of him just cutting in from any wing and scoring from 30
exactly,
yards.
Then his sort of legacy would be tainted if he came back and had one bad season.
Mm.
He should have left after Kiev. I mean, it's easy to say in hindsight. I know he was thinking Zidane's going, I can stay and I'll be Lopetegui's guy and everything. But he had such a rough season, and he finally got his massive moment of redemption. Second Champions League that he literally hand delivered to Real Madrid. He should have been like, all right, toodles, and because Man United would have paid him anything he wanted to come to Old Trafford then, you know, and he would have had to ride out Mourinho's final season and whatever. But it
could have all been different though with Gareth Bale. Because one thing about Gareth Bale is, as though yes, he's not the same player that left Spurs, because as I've mentioned before, I think he's almost put on too much muscle.
Yeah,
and he's just he's waiting to explode. He's someone with that much sort of physical explosion ready to go at any moment. And that's why he can throw it so far.
Yeah.
Because he's an absolute athlete, but that takes its toll on your body. And because there's no guarantee of fitness, there's no guarantee of it being worthwhile financially, as Sam mentioned there, you're going to have to pay a lot to the team to get him, and then you're going to have to pay Gareth Bale a lot of money to keep him there. It's one of the saddest things that we might just have someone that was, remember, winning PFA Player of the Year, Young Player of the Year, the sorts of awards that Ronaldo were picking up, Hazard picked up. We might just see him rotting on the bench in La Liga.
It would be such a shame to see.
I really hope Napoli secretly have all the money that De Laurentiis always says that they do have, because I'd love to see him at Napoli, because his best play at Real Madrid was under Carlo Ancelotti. And actually so is James Rodriguez's. Both of them should go to Napoli, frankly. That's what they should do. And Napoli have previously bailed Real Madrid out when they needed to sell someone for a certain amount. I know they bought Gonzalo Higuain for like €50 million back when Madrid had their initial splurge. So maybe they'll do it again. It would be lovely to see him play for a club where he is adored and given the special treatment that he deserves. He's such a good player. Mm. Like, he's not a Real Madrid kind of player, a Zidane kind of player. No, he's not. He's not a finesse player. No, he's not, but he's excellent. He's lightning. He's like watching this at what bang, goal, bang, assist, bang,
and
run.
Look at what he does for Wales as well. He plays in a team where, in terms of quality of career and what they've done, obviously, he's Real Madrid. He's won the Champions League three times. Like, he plays in a Wales squad that is the level yet, and though they are very exciting for the future, he is far and beyond the superstar in that team.
Easily.
But he plays so selflessly in that team up front.
Yeah.
Willing to take those long throws that I will just keep banging on about.
He's such a nice bloke. That's the thing.
It makes you wonder why has he got this massive riff with Zidane? Like,
it's basically, I think, Zidane tried to transition Real Madrid to more possession-based football. It worked and it didn't work. I mean, Cruz's passing numbers are obscene and Modric obviously very helps. And the thing is, Zidane likes Isco a lot. He liked Isco a lot, put Isco in a big prominent role when Bale was injured. This is the thing. Madrid's only really genuinely great season in the last few years has been that 2016-17 when they won the Liga and they won the Champions League as well. And the reason that season was so great is because, not because of Bale got injured, but Bale was unlucky. He got injured in that season and Isco came into the side. And they played so well in that diamond that Zidane is just like, I don't think he can let the idea go, basically.
Well, that's the thing as well, as we've said with people having credit and not being playing stuff. If you've got Ronaldo, Benzema and Isco ticking and winning you games, then you can't put Bale in the team. Because you have to completely distort that team.
And then everything else, when Christian left and it was Bale's time to step up, everything went against him. But everyone else in the squad was like, nah, you're all right. We just won three Champions League in a row. We're going to take the first half of the season off. And then Lopetegui got sacked. And then Solari was in and out. And it was so unfortunate for him because his time to shine. I mean, he is comfortable with himself. He didn't step up and do what he should have done.
Yeah, of course.
Everything else went, nothing went for him. None of the breaks went his way. And it's a shame because he's a wonderful player. He's a wonderful man by all accounts as well. And he's every right to be like, oh, you know what, Real Madrid? I'll just sit here and take my money, mate.
Yeah. And that's the thing is now the teams that could potentially, and we were said about Man United
They would have jumped at it.
They've now not got Champions League football and they have signed a Welsh player. But it's Daniel James, who is at the complete other end of his career, who is lightning fast and probably has the potential to barter someone if given the opportunity. but he's been signed, so it probably means that Man United aren't going to be the ones in for Gareth Bale.
No.
So we'll leave that saga there. That's one of the transfers where you know he probably wants to be sold by the club. But there's just no good fit at the moment. As you said, it would be lovely to see James and Bale go to Napoli or Spurs. But you just can't match them up with the clubs. So we'll move on to the last final section, which is Man United. And obviously, if you haven't seen it yet, on the Squawker YouTube channel, there's a 20-minute documentary about what is next for Manchester United, which discusses transfers, philosophy, Solskjaer, what next. That's a really good watch. We're going to dive into the transfer part of it, as it is the Squawker Scout section. Daniel James arrives. Yes, has had blistering moments, but 4 goals, 7 assists, I think, for Swansea is nothing at 21 years old to completely write home about. The best video I've seen of him is not only the sprint, but him is also his surprise birthday present, the dog he was given.
Oh, I was going to say, the vroom vroom commentary for his goal.
That was a lovely reaction. But this is the thing, is Man United's transfer policy has gone from one season where they could have signed Gareth Bale to potentially signing young players for the future. Now, what does Daniel James' arrival tell us about Man United?
United are going young, United are going fast. that's basically it. Look, Solskjaer, clearly when he came in, United, he wanted to play blisteringly quick football. United only had 3 forwards capable of doing that. When they all got injured in one game, United fell apart. You know, so James is going to be there. They're going to go fast. They're going to go young. You look at their link with Haller, who's an excellent target man, would really help everyone play well. Madison is also linked with great set pieces, will help them. You know, if their speed can't break teams down, his set pieces could help them do it. Do you know what I mean? And then the one different, and then Wan-Bissaka again, excellent, very quick, very very skillful player, great in duels. Will help them defensively and offensively. And then finally, the one they've been linked with, the big guy, Koulibaly, just because they need a world class centre half to organise that whole mess of a defence. And
They've not got that last year. They still clung on. That's why Mourinho said it was his best ever achievement, because they had the Champions League pool. Now it's so different. Tom, if you were going to pick a player, Daniel James arrives, if you were Man United and you were going to pick one player that you needed to get through the door next, which name are you putting out there?
Koulibaly. The guy's just a beast, man. Like, I actually love him. He's such a good defender. Tall, pacey, strong, clever, like... And like Mo says, like
willing to push teammates in front of other teams when Kylian Mbappe is running through on the ball. So you think centre back is the next position?
Oh yeah, 100%. Like their defence is a bit bit of a mismatch. Like, obviously, Eric Bailly, there's still question marks whether he's going to go or not. What's it called? Lindelof's had a pretty strong end to the season.
Yeah.
Lindelof's been good, but I think he's clearly not the alpha defender. The guy.
Like, Koulibaly will be like the big presence in the defense. He could be Man United's Virgil van Dijk.
There you go. Yeah. You heard it here. Koulibaly coming in to shore up that defense, and with a partnership with Lindelof could be decent.
They both got their games sync up very well, and Lindelof would finally get to play on the right, as Mourinho hinted all the time that he can only do.
Sam, your shout for need to sign player for Manchester United.
Yeah, I think they really need to get that Wan-Bissaka deal over the line. So a lot of reports coming out, they've already had a bid turned down, and I think missing out on him will have ramifications for United, in the sense that 5, 6, 7 years ago, if they wanted to sign any player from another Premier League club, even if they were a sort of direct rival, if they went for them, then they would get them. Mm. Not quite no questions asked, but close enough to that.
Well, look at Van Persie.
Of course.
What a glorious man.
The smaller teams now are in a better position to reject the big bids. But I think if they go big for Wan-Bissaka and don't manage to get him, considering he's playing for a club that is battling relegation or hoping to crack the top 10, it's another sign, I think, of how far they're slipping down the pecking order if they can't attract those sort of players, young English, ahead of other clubs.
But you look at, and obviously the prices are all relative to how much more money everyone's getting, but 40 million is the reported bid, isn't it, that's been rejected. But Crystal Palace looking for 60 million.
I mean, that's
for Wan-Bissaka, which you almost say, yeah, pay it. But then you sort of take a step back and you think, 60 million pounds. Yeah, like that Arsenal's reported budget this year is 40 million.
Yeah.
But then, player sales. So a budget's worth for a Europa League club on a right back who, let's remember that for Crystal Palace, Wan-Bissaka is built to play to his strengths, which is 1v1s all day long, winning tackles, dribbling past players, taking it on. What happens when you're transitioned into the team that does have more of the ball and is reliant on what you do on it? Wan-Bissaka played as a forward, got moved to right back. He is technically good enough to do it, but it would be 60 million on a player that is being lifted from one side of play to another. Because again, on the Man United documentary on YouTube, the discussion was that Man United played this counter-attacking style, but they perhaps want to be a slightly more dominant and put on the front foot. We haven't seen Wan-Bissaka do that yet. So you're spending 60 million on a potential right back who we all think is going to be wonderful, but there's still that element of risk that means 60 million might be
of course,
too
but if
much.
If you're one of the biggest clubs like Man United are, and your transfer policy is now that you're going after players with potential, then you have to expect that you're going to have to pay those fees, because you're buying Wan-Bissaka on the basis that Crystal Palace will be saying, well, he could be your right back for the next 10 years.
Yeah.
So you're always going to have to pay those fees. Obviously, that's the difficulty of being the biggest club, because if it was, you know, I don't know, Leicester or Everton trying to sign him, then it might not be as big a thing.
Yeah, and look at Leicester when they picked up Maddison. It was 25 million. That looks like a snip now. And Man United have obviously been linked. That'll be double that, at least, if Wan-Bissaka is going for 60 million as well.
Because don't forget, we've got the under 21s as well. So either of them have a really, really strong tournament. Yeah, they could be adding another couple of zeros.
Like you said, they need to sign them now before the tournament. But after the tournament, forget about it. Because I don't know about Wan-Bissaka necessarily, but Maddison 100% is going to have a great tournament. I can just tell. And they're the two guys, you know, because like you said, young English players, you've got to play a premium anyway. They're both so important to what United are going to do. Wan-Bissaka, I agree that if you're going to have possession heavy football, maybe he's not the ideal fullback. But the thing is, if you're not, you watch United's fullbacks are so bad defensively. And what if you have Wan-Bissaka, then if nothing else, you can move. If you have Wan-Bissaka and Koulibaly, what you can do is you can just send Shaw forward to be your left winger, have James on your right wing, and then just sort of shift across to a back three when you have possession.
Becomes like an asymmetric style that relies... you're literally like... In the same way that Van Dijk is left on his own for Liverpool to marshal them into corners and just defend on his own, you manipulate it so that everyone, to score a goal against Man United, you have to get past the player who can't be dribbled past, essentially.
Exactly. And I mean, you have Lindelof in the middle on the cover, you have Koulibaly one second hand in the flank.
So there you go. So obviously you mentioned a few targets there, though. We had Tom... back in Koulibaly is the signing they need to make. Sam thinks, just get Wan-Bissaka up now. To end the podcast, who's your Man United must-sign
Madison.
Player?
I think Madison. Just to be different, first of all, but also because he's going to have a great tournament. They need to get him now. He's really special. Beckham-esque, mate. Beckham-esque.
Well, there you go. The Beckham brilliance to return to Old Trafford this summer, according to Mohamed Butt. And obviously, let us know all your Squawker Scouts that you'd like us to discuss, but that is unfortunately all we've got time for on this week's podcast. So just a quick thank you to all of the guests. Make sure you're subscribing, reviewing, rating the Squawker Talker, and we will see you next week.